The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're looking at the way our brains store and recall memories. We're joined by author, university professor, and pioneering researcher, Dr. Elizabeth Loftus. But first, let's learn about a new study on the ways that the photo lineups can affect the memories of people who've witnessed a crime. I'm here with Dr. Gary Wells. Gary is the Distinguished Professor of Psychology and the Wendy and Mark Stavish Chair in Social Sciences at Iowa State University. He's also a researcher with the Center for Forensic Science and Public Policy of the American Judicature Society in Des Moines, Iowa. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should point out that our producer, K.O. Myers, also works for AJS as Director of Research and Programs. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Gary.
Thank you very much.
Now, you're here to talk about your new paper, A Test of the Simultaneous versus Sequential Lineups Method. So tell us about that.
It's kind of a mouthful. This has to do with eyewitness identification from lineups. Most people have some sense of what that means. Most people have seen, for example, lineups on television in which somebody was a witness to a crime, maybe a victim, and they are shown a lineup with the idea of trying to pick out the perpetrator. It's a very important form of evidence, heavily used in the criminal justice system. Yet it's a problematic form of evidence. We know from really three different sources now of information that eyewitness misidentification is a problem. First, we know from the kinds of controlled laboratory experiments that I've been doing for over 30 years now, where we create events for unsuspecting people and then follow it up with a lineup and see how they do in identifying the person, and one of the first things you find is that a lot of people make errors. We also know, though, that eyewitness identification is sort of problematic because when forensic DNA testing came along in the 1990s, most people think of forensic DNA as something that incriminates the guilty, and it does do that. It also has this other power, and that is to, under the right circumstances, exonerate someone, prove that they did not commit a particular crime. And so there are now over 273 DNA exonerations, people who were convicted by juries of crimes they did not do, and three out of every four of those are cases of mistaken identification. The third reason we know that eyewitness identification can be quite problematic is because of archival studies looking at police records where witnesses very often pick fillers. A filler is a person who is in the lineup merely to fill it out. They're not a suspect. It's like if it were a live lineup. I'm sorry, Mrs. Jones, you just picked Officer Krupke. So we have these forms of evidence indicating that eyewitness misidentification is a problem. And the idea was to test something that we had developed in our laboratory studies that works better than the traditional lineup, called a sequential lineup. Now, in the traditional lineup, which we now call a simultaneous lineup, everybody's presented as a group. This is how people see it, for example, on television. Let's say it's six people in this lineup. They all stand up together, and they're there as a group. Or if it's a photographic lineup, which is actually the way in which most lineups are done in this country, all, let's say, six photographs are shown to the witness at once. And we had good theoretical reasons to test this. Maybe it would work better if witnesses were presented with individuals in the lineup one at a time. So it's the same kind of thing. It's Mrs. Jones, I have a number of people to show you. I'm going to show them to you one at a time. And you make a decision on each one. Is that the person you saw commit the crime? Yes, no, not sure, before we go to the next one. And in our lab studies, we show that that works better. So we wanted to take that out and use it in the field with real eyewitnesses to serious crimes. And that's what this report is all about.
What made you think that one would be better than the other, one method?
One of the things that we were observing from our studies was that when witnesses view a lineup, the traditional one at least, the simultaneous one, what they do is they compare one lineup member to another. They're making those kinds of comparisons. Then they try to determine, well, who looks most like my memory of the perpetrator? And then the propensity or tendency that they have is to identify that person. Now, that works reasonably well if the real perpetrator is in the lineup. But if the real perpetrator is not in the lineup, there's always someone who looks more like them than the others. That's something that we call a relative judgment. That is, who looks most like him relative to the others. That's not what we really want witnesses doing. We want witnesses using recognition memory. Is that the person or not? Not who looks most like him.
So this is the human propensity to find patterns.
Well, that's right. And in general, human beings, I think, are primarily wired, whether they're estimating the size of something or whatever, it's mostly just relative judgments. It's this relative to that. Oh, this is a lot of money relative to that, but it's not much money relative to that. And that really doesn't work well with respect to a lineup. So the idea of the sequential is that it really prevents them, for the most part, from just comparing one person to another. When the witness looks at the first one and, let's say, says no, and the second one says no, gets to the third one, it's true that the witness can sort of make comparisons. Well, this third one looks more like him than number one or two did, but I don't know what number four is going to look like. Number four might look even more like him. So the idea is that the witness has to dig deeper, compare each person to their memory, and make something that we call more of an absolute identification decision as opposed to a relative one.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Dr. Gary Wells, professor of psychology at Iowa State University, and the author of a new study comparing simultaneous and sequential lineup methods. So what exactly were your results?
We created this design for this experiment very carefully. It has a lot of really important control properties. You see, when we do these studies in the laboratory where we created the event, we know who the real perpetrator is because
right.
It was one of our people. But out in the real world, we don't really know. We know who the police have as a suspect. That person might or might not be the perpetrator. But we don't really know if they picked that suspect. Was that an accurate pick? So what we did in this study was we dealt with these police departments. That's the San Diego Police Department, the Tucson, Arizona Police Department, the Austin, Texas Police Department, and the Charlotte, North Carolina Police Department. And we got a lot of agreements from them. For example, one agreement in doing this experiment was that they would put one suspect in the lineups, and everyone else would just be a filler. So all six-person lineups, one person's the suspect, the other five are known innocent fillers. That way, whenever the witness picks a filler, we know they made a mistake. And if the sequential is a better procedure than the simultaneous, then they should be picking fewer fillers. And hopefully, not picking fewer suspects. And that's what we found. We ended up with about 497, actually, of these lineups being conducted. These witnesses did not know they were part of a study. These are real witnesses to serious crimes. Some of them were victims. The crimes ranged from simple theft to murder cases. And when they viewed their lineup, at the very last second, it was randomly determined whether they would do it using the sequential method or the simultaneous method. Regardless of which method was used, simultaneous or sequential, a little over a quarter of the time, about 26 to 27% of the time, they identified the suspect. But with the traditional simultaneous method, 18% of the time, slightly over 18%, they picked a filler. But with the sequential method, they identified a filler only about 12% of the time. So there was a net savings. The sequential actually produced fewer errors than did the simultaneous, but it did not lower the rate at which they were able to pick out the suspect.
If police departments did actually move to the sequential method, they wouldn't necessarily see more positive IDs of criminals, but there would be less false positives.
And that's very important because we just talked about, for example, the DNA exoneration cases. Mm-hmm. It turns out among the conclusions that we make is that mistaken eyewitness identification is accounting for more of these convictions of innocent people than all other causes combined. So it's very important that we get to the bottom of that and we use whatever the best techniques are informed by science to minimize those mistaken identifications. Of course, these were identifications of fillers, so obviously in this study, no one is bringing charges against these fillers who were mistakenly identified. They instead kind of serve as our index of how the witnesses are doing under these two procedures. But in real cases, you always have fillers in the lineup. And when a witness picks a filler, it really spoils that witness for any subsequent ID. So suppose you're a detective, and you think maybe Joe committed this crime. Let's say it's a 7-Eleven robbery. You think Joe committed this 7-Eleven robbery. So you put Joe into a lineup, and the witness picks a filler. And then someone gives you a phone call and say, hey, you know who actually committed that 7-Eleven robbery? It was Frank. Well, then let's get the witness back in here. Let's put together a lineup with Frank. Whoops, too late. The witness was already spoiled by having picked a filler. So it's not just innocent suspects we're concerned about getting tripped up with this traditional simultaneous lineup. It can actually give the perpetrators a free ride.
Right.
You burnt the only witness you had because you used a procedure that has this higher risk of identifying a filler, so you got nothing now. Maybe an anonymous tip, but where's the evidence?
Now, something else that you did that I found quite interesting with this study, you discarded lineups that weren't double-blind.
One requirement was that the person who administers the lineup cannot be the case detective. They have to use what is commonly called the double-blind lineup procedure, which is something that I created back in 1988. The person who administers the lineup can influence the witness. They can steer witnesses away from fillers or toward the suspect, or influence how the witness feels about their identification, how certain they are in their identification. We wanted to eliminate all of that problem here. We're trying to test, in a pure sense, the witness's memory, so we required them to be done double-blind. Now, they needed kind of an opt-out in the sense that if there's no other detective around to administer the lineup who doesn't know which person is the suspect and which are fillers, because of the particular time in the shift in which it's being done or for some other reason, they could still do this photographic lineup, but that gets set aside. It's fundamentally the same kind of logic, for
right.
the most part, for which other requirements within science require double-blind testing.
What really struck me, I guess, about this is that means that some police departments aren't in the habit of double-blinding lineups?
Well, most are not, but many are now. I mean, I've been pressing this issue for many, many years. Now, in all of the state of New Jersey, all of the state of North Carolina, a number of major police departments like Boston, Denver, Dallas, they do follow the double-blind procedure now. But our estimate at this point is that probably somewhere between 20 and 25% police departments in the U.S. have switched over to using double-blind procedures. The standard procedure is for the case detective to be the one who administers the lineup to the witness, and I think it's the most important problem that we need to deal with. Mm-hmm. I think it's more important than the sequential. I'm not suggesting that detectives intentionally influence witnesses, but there's just a lot of data over many, many years showing how a person who administers a test, their beliefs, their expectations, their hopes, their belief about what the correct answer is influences the person they're testing.
If somebody is involved very closely with the case and has been working on this case for a long time, I understand that that could definitely interfere.
Well, yes, and the ways in which it works are sometimes kind of subtle. For instance, let's say that you're a detective. You put your person in position 3. And the witness looks at the lineup and says, well, number 2, now, the detective says, take your time. Be sure you look at everyone, right? And that alone will lead the witness off of number 2. Whereas if the witness says, well, number 3, yes, tell me about number 3. Very different reaction.
Right.
So under the right circumstances, it's really almost the case detective making the ID for the witness. Witnesses often look to the case detective for cues. And so the double-blind lineup is really important. We used it in this study, but what I'm arguing and what many of us are now arguing is that it should be the way in which all lineups are done. Especially when, like I was saying before, almost all of these lineups, the initial identification, is really a photographic lineup. It's just the case detective and the witness. There's no one else there to witness this or observe this. It's not audio taped. It's not videotaped. And I think that these detectives don't really understand the extent to which they may be influencing the witness.
I did notice that the subtitle of your paper was an initial report of the AJS National Eyewitness Identification Field Studies. So what will you be studying next then?
Well, the data that we obtained from this is so rich. There's so much there.
I bet.
What we did was, our first run at this is to look at this kind of focal question that we had. How did witnesses do with the sequential lineup versus the simultaneous lineup? But we also, for the first time ever, have collected data on lots of other things. For example, we have every photo of every person that was used in this study. So we can go in, we can analyze for biases in these photo lineups. But also, we collected information on things like, was there a weapon used? How close was the witness to the perpetrator when they witnessed this? What were the lighting conditions? Whether the witness was under the influence of alcohol or any drugs? We have audio tapes of every lineup that was done, so we can listen to those audio tapes and listen to the witnesses as they reason their way through these photo lineups, so that we can, for example, score these using blind procedures. Well, the person who's scoring these, let's say, audio tapes, does not know, did the person that the witness picked here, was it a filler or was it the suspect? That'll allow us to take these kinds of scores, this kind of content analysis, and see if we can figure out how to sort between accurate identifications and mistaken identifications based on these kinds of clues or cues.
You're doing fantastic research, sir, and really important. And we are out of time, so thanks very much for being here, Gary. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You can find a link to Dr. Gary Wells and his work on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
I'm here with Elizabeth Loftus. Dr. Loftus is a distinguished professor in the Department of Psychology and Social Behavior, the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society, and the Department of Cognitive Sciences at the University of California, Irvine, where she's also a fellow of the Center for the Neurobiology of Learning and Memory. She's a pioneer of memory research and the author of many books, including The Myth of Repressed Memory, False Memories and Allegations of Sexual Abuse, and Witness for the Defense, The Accused, The Eyewitness, and The Expert Who Puts Memory on Trial. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Dr. Loftus.
Thank you.
Now, you've done so much fascinating research in your career, and we're definitely going to talk about as much of it as we can. But before we dive in, I want to give our listeners sort of a sense of how this became your life's work. So I've read that you discovered psychology as an undergraduate at UCLA, but you originally intended to be a math teacher?
Well, I was majoring in mathematics while I was an undergraduate at UCLA, and in fact, I did eventually get my bachelor's degree in mathematics, but I also got interested in psychology from taking an introductory psychology course, and then I was hooked on it. So I took all my electives in psychology and ended up with enough credits to have a double major. So that was my entree into psychology. I guess I kind of owe it all to a great introductory psychology teacher.
Well, when did you get interested in studying memory?
I went to graduate school, and I chose a program that had a specialty in mathematical psychology. I thought, well, that's perfect. It combines my interest and aptitude in mathematics and my excitement about psychology. And it was during my years in graduate school that I began to do some work with one of my professors on a study of memory. And so that started my interest in memory, but I didn't begin to do the kind of work that ultimately would become my passion until I'd already gotten my PhD and was kind of off on my own being an academic. That's when I started doing some experiments on eyewitness testimony and continued on doing them for decades.
Well, your research has really been a part of a revolution in the way that we understand memory in the brain. Did you have any hint that there was such a fundamental shift coming that when you were starting your research?
Oh, no. I mean, all I knew is some point early in my career, I wanted to do some research that had some practical application to it. And as somebody then who had some expertise and experience in the area and study of memory, but an interest in legal cases, it was kind of a natural intersection there to study the memory of witnesses to crimes and accidents and other events that are important in legal cases. And that's what I started to do. And I began to do experiments where I was showing people films of accidents or simulated crimes. Hardly anybody was doing anything like that at that time.
Well, one of the big things that's changed is our basic understanding of how memory works. And the common, I would say, misconception is that our brains sort of store little home movies and then we just sort of call them out when we need them. So have scientists ever really thought that that was an accurate model?
I mean, there is a public belief, a lay belief, that memory,
right,
especially if it's a traumatic event, registers itself like a video recording of some sort, and you store it and then you play it back later. But scientists today certainly know that that is not the way memory works, that actually what we're doing is taking in bits and pieces of experience. Sometimes we combine our experiences together, and we are really constructing or reconstructing what happened to us in the past. And so we now talk about memory as being malleable, susceptible to distortion and influence and change. You know, most of the time, it doesn't matter very much, but when it comes to legal cases, very, very precise memory does matter, and it can be a matter of life or death.
Well, now you mentioned memory change. Sometimes we're talking about quite a radical change to fit our current perceptions.
Well, yeah, sometimes you can see small distortions in memory, people remembering the car went through a red light instead of a green light, for example. But sometimes you can get entire memories planted in the minds of people, memories for things that didn't happen. And in my own laboratory work, we have studied both the smaller alterations of memory and these what we now call very rich false memories.
So let's make sure everybody understands how certain we are of a memory does not indicate at all how reliable it actually is.
I guess I would qualify that a little. The when you do express a memory report, when you say, you know, this is what happened to me in the past, you can sometimes and often actually will attach a level of certainty or confidence to it. And one of the things that we have found, we meaning the psychological scientists who work in this area, is that the relationship between how accurate somebody is and how confident they are can be a rather weak one. So we can be very confident about things that did happen, but we can also be very confident about things that didn't happen. And so the scientists would actually like to see people rely less on the certainty level of somebody who's telling you about their memory, and to rely more on other kinds of factors.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking with Dr. Elizabeth Loftus, author, memory researcher, and elected member of the National Academy of Sciences. So that's actually really the focus of a lot of your research, is that sort of legal context. And especially in the context of criminal trials, eyewitness testimony has kind of been the gold standard, has it not?
Well, one thing you can say is that eyewitness testimony is very powerful. And when you get somebody, you know, on the stand saying, I'm absolutely positive, I was so frightened when I saw that this is exactly what happened and that's the guy, people want to believe it. They have a tendency to believe it, whether it's accurate or inaccurate. And I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but there are now hundreds and hundreds of legal cases where innocent people have been wrongfully convicted of crimes they didn't do, served sentences of 5, 10, 15, 20 years or more, and now DNA has shown that these people are actually innocent. When you analyze their cases, the major cause of those wrongful convictions is faulty eyewitness testimony, faulty human memory. So I think it behooves us to try to figure out, you know, what can we do to minimize the chances of this happening to other people?
Absolutely agreed. One of the things that I found was really interesting is that especially when somebody's involved in sort of a scary or a stressful event, their memory is actually worse.
One of the things about if you are extra frightened or super aroused, because you're experiencing something pretty awfully traumatic or horrifying, the memory can suffer, particularly for the peripheral details. So, you know, there's a recent study that has been done by a psychiatrist named Charles Morgan and his collaborators, where you look at soldiers and sailors, military personnel who are undergoing a very stressful interaction, interview with someone, and those who had the very stressful, frightening kind of interaction were less able to make an accurate identification of the person who was conducting that interview. That's just one example of a study that shows that a highly arousing event can be associated with detriments in memory, and it just is in contrast to this incorrect and lay belief that if you have a traumatic experience, it'll leave this indelible imprint in the mind and you'll be able to accurately remember it.
Well, in fact, that attitude itself may, or it seems to be changing within the legal community. The New Jersey Supreme Court recently ruled to permit closer scrutiny of the accuracy of eyewitness testimony. Can you tell us about that?
Well, yes. New Jersey a case called Henderson, and then there's a companion case to it. It's an eyewitness case. And when the New Jersey Supreme Court considered this case, they issued a new legal standards for evaluating eyewitness evidence in a case. So if there's any showing now of possible suggestion in the eyewitness aspects of the case, the court in New Jersey now has to have a hearing and thoroughly scrutinize the eyewitness evidence in the case, and then issue relevant jury instructions for how they should consider this eyewitness evidence. So it really was kind of a revolutionary, bold decision that showed a great appreciation for the psychological science on the subject of eyewitness testimony and the ability of people to be eyewitnesses. And I think it's gone a long way, at least in New Jersey, towards maximizing the chances that the verdicts will be just.
So would you say that this has been sort of a struggle to get, the law to catch up to the science?
Well, it's a struggle that we've been engaged in, I would say, for decades. I mean, for a long time, there was an effort on the part of some attorneys and some psychologists to get judges to allow expert testimony in criminal and even in civil cases where eyewitness issues were paramount. And for a long time, judges were very resistant to having this kind of testimony, this expert testimony, be introduced into court cases. And then what happened is we began to see a string of reversals, starting with the state of Arizona, where the Arizona Supreme Court in the early 1980s reversed a conviction in a murder case because the judge refused to allow the defense to introduce expert testimony on eyewitness issues. And after that Arizona case, a number of other states followed, and you would see the reversals of convictions for excluding this expert testimony. But it took a while. There was a lot of resistance, and there still continues to be pockets of resistance to this form of educating the jury.
So what do you think that resistance is based on, then?
Some judges would say, look, everybody knows all this stuff. It's all a matter of common knowledge. People perceive and remember things all the time. You don't need an expert to tell people about things they already know. In fact, there are many studies that show that many of the things that the experts do talk about are not common knowledge, that people in general, jurors in particular, hold beliefs that are inconsistent with the scientific evidence or even contradicted by scientific evidence or unsupported by scientific evidence. That's one thing that you sometimes hear as a reason for not wanting to pay attention to this science. It's all common knowledge. I think possibly people are afraid, are we going to have expert testimony in every court case where there's an eyewitness? It's going to be time-consuming. It'll be expensive. So there may be other reasons as well. Maybe they think it's going to open the doors to guilty people being freed.
So it's not necessarily the science that they're debating then?
Well, sometimes they do attack the science, or they'll say, the findings are not necessarily generally accepted or whatever. But we also have evidence about general acceptance, so that argument doesn't fly very well.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking with memory researcher Elizabeth Loftus. We'll be back to talk about some of her pioneering studies on the subject of memory after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at what happens when a bedrock scientific theory goes up for debate in the contentious realm of politics. We'll speak to Dr. Eugenie Scott and Stephen Newton of the National Center for Science Education about evolution as a political issue. And anthropologist and blogger Greg Layden analyzes the fallout of the so-called ClimateGate emails. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Dr. Elizabeth Loftus. Dr. Loftus is a professor of law and psychology, a prolific author, and a researcher of human memory. She's a member of the Scientific and Professional Advisory Board of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, and in 2002, she was named one of the 100 most influential researchers in psychology in the 20th century by the Review of General Psychology. Now, I want to talk about a paper that you published in 1974. It was called Reconstruction of Automobile Destruction, an example of the interaction between language and memory. Now, your hypothesis here was that the way a question about an event was phrased might actually influence the way that a witness recalled it.
Well, what we did in that study, and oh, you're taking me back here, but is we showed people films of accidents, and then we questioned people about the speed of the cars that were involved in the accident, but we asked different witnesses different questions. So some of them were asked, how fast were the cars going when they hit each other? Others were asked, how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other? And one of the things we found is that the wording of the question affected the answer people gave. They told us the cars were going faster. If we used the word smashed, then other witnesses reported who had been questioned with the word hit. So this is an example of how the wording of a question can affect the answer that somebody gives you. But we took things a step further, and we went on later to ask people, did you see any broken glass? And we found that if we had used the word smashed with people, they were far more likely to later tell us that they'd seen broken glass when there wasn't any involved in that accident. And so what we were showing here is that the way you word a question affects not just the immediate answer, but it can have a long-range effect, and it can actually, it appears, contaminate or distort or transform the memory of a witness. So, you know, if you ask how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other, it implies a more severe accident. People reconstruct the event in a way that makes it more severe, and now are more likely to think that they saw broken glass even when there wasn't any.
To me, that is truly groundbreaking research. What led you to suspect that that might be the case?
Actually, when I started doing work on eyewitness testimony, I was interested in how the wording of a question affected the answer people gave. So we did some early studies. The hit versus smashed was one of them. Asking people a question like, did you see the broken headlight versus did you see a broken headlight, just changing the article from a definite to an indefinite, that little change affected the answer people gave. So initially I was just interested in the wording of a question and how it affected the immediate answer. But then we stumbled on the effects that these early questions could have an effect on later questions. And you know, once I saw that and was trying to understand, well, what are these questions doing? And I think they're actually contaminating the memory. We began to do more research that essentially supported that hypothesis.
So basically, people are constructing false memories of their own, one on top of each other, due to being led.
Well, if they're helped by the leading question, yes.
Amazing. And now I'm going to take you to another study. It is more recent, but still not recent. In 1978, you were part of another study that featured cars called Semantic Integration of Verbal Information into a Visual Memory. Now, that was one of the first studies into something that's come to be known as the misinformation effect. Can you explain what that is?
Again, this was a study where we were showing people simulated accidents. By the way, I managed to get some funding from the U.S. Department of Transportation to support my laboratory and the research going on in it. And so they were interested in accidents. And many of my early studies involved testing people about memory for accidents. But the conclusions really apply to any kind of complex event or many different kinds of complex events. But in the 78 study, we showed people a simulated accident. A car, for example, may go through a yield sign at the intersection, and with a single leading question that insinuated that it was a stop sign and not a yield sign, we got lots of people to believe and remember that they saw a stop sign instead of a yield sign, just with a single leading question. And, you know, ultimately we would refer to this phenomenon as the misinformation effect. When you give people misinformation about some of the details of an event that they've actually seen themselves, you can distort their memory. Now, people in the field refer to this as the misinformation effect.
What are some of the factors that can make the effect more or less pronounced?
One of the things that we know is that if some time passes and the memory is weakened because of the passage of time, it's more susceptible to being contaminated by misinformation. So if I want to deliberately distort somebody's memory, which is what we do in these experiments in order to mm-hmm. study the process, I know that if I try to do it immediately, I'm going to have a little harder time than if I wait several days or a week and then go in and expose my experimental subjects to misinformation. It's easier to contaminate a memory that has been weakened to some extent. You know, that's one factor
right.
that's important.
Well, you've also shown that there are factors that can make an individual witness more susceptible to the influence of misinformation.
Well, yeah, I mean, and this is one. The passage of time is a factor that makes them more susceptible. You know, there are also some individual differences. I often get asked, you know, is everybody susceptible to this kind of contamination of their memory? And I actually believe we all are susceptible to these kinds of contaminations, but some people are somewhat more susceptible than others. So if you're somebody who tends to have lapses in memory and attention, you're a little more susceptible to contamination through misinformation. If you score well on a standard intelligence test, you're somewhat less susceptible to contamination.
Interesting.
Well, I mean, it doesn't mean you're immune. We can still, you know, we can still plant some things in your mind, but you're a little bit more resistant to those influences.
Do we have a clear understanding of what happens in the brain that makes it hard to keep from incorporating bad information into our memories?
I'm not sure. I mean, we do. I mean, what
neurologically?
One of the things that we know from some neuroimaging studies is that, well, you might be able, if you have a group of true memories and you have a group of false memories that arose through misinformation, so people believing things that really didn't happen, the neural signals for the true and false memories are actually very similar to each other. You can sometimes find, you know, some statistical differences, small ones between a group of true and a group of false memories, but the overwhelming impression is that these neural signatures are very similar to each other.
Well, now this leads me directly to the controversy over recovered memory therapy. Now, at the risk of spoilers, I'm going to start out by saying that your research has shown pretty convincingly that patients who underwent recovered memory therapy really didn't recover anything, let's say.
Well, you know, in the 90s especially, and you know, it continues, there has been a huge controversy about recovered memories because we did see, you know, thousands of people, you know, going into therapy, engaging in some kind of suggestive procedures that led them to think they remembered things that they hadn't ever reported before. In one case, a woman remembering that she'd been raped between the ages of 5 and 16 by her father, that she'd been forced to have sex with the family dog, all allegedly buried into her unconscious until she was 18 years old and became aware of these experiences. And the big problem here is that these suggestive procedures, it looks more like they were planting false memories in the minds of these patients rather than extracting true ones. And many, many people suffered as a result of these activities.
Well, where did the idea that memories could be recovered come from in the first place?
I'm not sure I can quite figure that out. I mean, the idea of repression, of horrific brutalization, it's kind of a hand-me-down Freudian idea that you can, you know, have all these horrible experiences and banish them into the unconscious. But it didn't really kind of catch on until the late 1980s when women were starting to recover years of supposed brutalization, including years of supposed satanic ritual abuse. And a number of people talked state legislators into enacting new legislation that would toll the statute of limitations, essentially allowing people to sue other people or get people prosecuted based on these supposedly recovered, de-repressed memories. And we have seen, you know, more than a few innocent people get sued or prosecuted and imprisoned as a result of these unsubstantiated claims.
And I really do want to make that clear. Like, this was an epidemic of patients reporting these kinds of things at that point.
Oh, yes, it was, and thousands of them. And you know, of course, these kinds of things affect many more people than the thousands of patients. It's the people who get accused, their extended families. Families were split apart. Innocent people were you know, being sued civilly or prosecuted. I mean, it was a mess out there.
What brought that on?
I mean, it's hard. I think you need to talk to maybe a sociologist or an anthropologist about that. You know,
right?
About that. I'm a memory expert. I mean, so I could give you my not very valuable opinion.
No, that's fair.
About that, but you know, I think, you know, these were the ideas that got into the heads of a few psychotherapists who then advanced these ideas in books that they wrote, in talks that they gave, in workshops that they gave, and, you know, pretty soon you had legions of psychotherapists believing that there were a bunch of multiple personality patients running around with, you know, with repressed memories that needed to be excavated.
Now, what made you suspect that these memories might not be genuine?
Well, I had been doing research on memory distortion for quite a while when I got contacted by an attorney. In this case, it was an attorney for a man named George Franklin, who was accused of murder based on nothing other than a supposedly repressed and de-repressed memory. It was the memory of that his daughter, his grown daughter, expressed, saying that she'd witnessed her father kill her best friend 20 years earlier, that she repressed her memory for that she repressed her memory for years of sexual brutalization that he committed upon her, and friends of his supposedly joined in. All of this allegedly repressed. And when his attorney called me and said, I've got this murder case, I've never had a case like this, I don't know how to think about it, what do you know about this concept of repression? And I said, well, I've heard of it. And when I then looked, in conjunction with some, you know, working on that court case for the evidence, I was shocked. There was no credible scientific support for the kind of thing being claimed in that case. And yet that was kind of the beginning, because we, you know, after that murder case, and there now began to be thousands of court cases generally involving allegations of sexual abuse, not murder. And when the state legislators had told the statute of limitations in the various states around the country, these very, very old cases, you know, claims from 20, 30, 40 years earlier, could go forward.
Now, you developed something called the lost in the mall technique in order to explore whether false memories could actually be implanted in patients.
So there I was thinking about, you know, George Franklin and the accusation that he had committed this murder and that he'd committed all these other brutalizations that were allegedly repressed. And, you know, the question came up, if these memories weren't real, where could they have come from?
Right.
If these events didn't happen, how could the daughter be thinking that they did? And is it possible that some therapy or other activities in her environment could have led to a planting of false memories? Well, at that time, my research showed you could turn a stop sign into a yield sign, or you could make somebody believe they saw broken glass, you know, when there wasn't any in the accident. But we had never done anything like trying to plant a complete false memory into the minds of someone. And so, actually, it took a couple of years. I would sit around with graduate students trying to figure out, well, how could we study this phenomenon? How could we come up with a procedure where we could plant a very rich false memory into the minds of people so we could study the process? Obviously, we weren't going to be able to get permission to plant memories that your father committed a murder and raped you for many years. So we needed an analog and eventually came up with the idea, let's see if we could get people to believe and remember that they, when they were 5 years old, they were lost in a shopping mall, that they were frightened, crying, ultimately rescued by an elderly person and reunited with the family. And that's the false memory that we eventually succeeded in planting, published the article, and was probably the first of these rich false memory studies.
Let's extend that. That was a fairly simple story and one that technically could have happened to anybody and probably has happened. But something as fantastical and horrible as some of these stories. Now, does that mean that they were implanted?
Well, first of all, after we published the Lost in the Mall study, some other investigators came along and did some wonderful follow-up work planning false memories that were more bizarre or more unusual or would have been more traumatic if they had actually happened. So they succeeded in getting their subjects to believe that they were, you know, hospitalized, that they had an accident at a family wedding, that they were attacked by a vicious animal, that they had a serious indoor accident, that they nearly drowned and had to be rescued by a lifeguard. All of these are examples of these rich false memories that psychological scientists have succeeded in planting in the minds of ordinary people. So you can't say anymore that people are immune to these influences and that this can't happen. And we believe, and many of these studies use techniques that were not all that different from the kinds of things that some psychotherapists were using with their patients that led them to these rather bizarre and unusual and extreme supposedly recovered memories.
So since I've watched too many movies, I'm thinking of something like The Manchurian Candidate. So implanting a memory is one thing, but can you actually implant something that will later cause someone to do something?
Well, I don't know
closer
about
to
the
hypnosis.
Candidate. But we have now shown that the false memories have consequences for people. So we have, we haven't done a Manchurian Candidate kind of study, but we have planted false memories and watched how they can affect a person's later thinking, intentions, and behaviors. So, for example, in a series of studies with my collaborators, we planted a false memory that as a child you got sick on a particular food, hard-boiled eggs, dill pickles, strawberry ice cream, or whatever, and we showed that later on, you don't want that food as much if you develop a false memory of having gotten sick on it as a child. So here you can see how the false memory is affecting people's later behavior.
That is slightly frightening, really. We are so suggestible as humans.
Well, you can think of it as frightening, or you can, you know, try to, I guess, look for the positive side of it.
Do tell.
I have thought, you know, why would we have been built with the memories that are so malleable? Why would Darwin, God, whatever your theory is, have created us with malleable memories? And it's possible that they serve a function, that they serve at times a useful function. A malleable memory means that if errors creep into your memory system spontaneously, that you can later correct them, and you can fix it up and you know, put in the true memory. And some memory distortions actually appear to be associated with positive things for people. So for example, people have prestige-enhancing distortions in memory that occur spontaneously. They remember that their grades were better than they really were, or that they voted in elections that they didn't vote in, or that their kids walked and talked in an earlier age than they really did. And these kinds of prestige-enhancing memory distortions may just allow us to feel better about ourselves.
I have long thought that faulty memory is the only reason why anyone has more than one child, honestly.
Well, I there is that thing about memory for pain that people seem to forget about when they go from child one to the next one.
So now, what new research in memory are you most excited about? Is there anything going on that you find particularly interesting?
In my lab right now, I mean, I've got a wonderful set of graduate students, and they're working on trying to find out more about memory distortion. One project, for example, involves comparing people's false memories that you were a victim of something versus a false memory that you perpetrated an act against someone else. That's the kind of false memory that can develop when people falsely confess to crimes they didn't do. And so are there similarities in those two different types of false memories? We're trying to learn more about who is susceptible to having their memory be distorted, and conversely, who is resistant to these kinds of influences. It's a active little lab that we're excited about learning more.
Well, now I'm wondering, how do you design a study to research something like that?
Well, in, let's say, the perpetrator versus victim, we just planted a false memory that somebody, when you were a kid, somebody punched you, versus for other subjects, when you were a kid, you punched someone else. And we can plant the false memories, you know, by... One common way is to give people false feedback about information that they supply. They may answer a whole bunch of questionnaires, and then we give them some false feedback. We tell them we fed all your information into our really smart computer program that determined that certain things probably happened to you as a kid. We want to tell you what the computer is telling us, and then have you try to remember these experiences. Or if you can't remember them, try to imagine when this might have happened to you. So that's all part of the suggestive process that leads people to develop false memories. And then we can look at whatever it is we're interested in. Who's susceptible? Who's resistant? What kinds of things increase the susceptibility or decrease it?
I'm just astonished at the work that you've done. You have produced so much fascinating research in your career, and we've barely scratched the surface. Dr. Lochtiff, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, my pleasure.
You can find out more about Dr. Elizabeth Loftus and her work through the links on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You'll also find links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.